Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 28 of the Runner's World podcast, the weekly podcast bringing you all the latest running news, views and interviews. I'm Rick Pearson, the Runner's World section editor, and I'm here with Ben Hobson, the digital editor. Ben, what have we got coming up on this week's episode?
This week we are discussing running books.
Rumour has it, Ben, you've been spotted in the parks of central London doing something that looks suspiciously like running. Are you on the comeback trail?
Oh God, yeah. Yes, I've been on three runs. Yeah, they've been fine. It's quite nice to be moving again. It feels quite hard. Just as a brief reminder to everyone who's out there running at the moment, it's hard. It's really difficult. It's 6 weeks, 8 weeks of not running and then running again, and it's like, wow, that hurts quite a lot.
But your knee is okay. Is that fair to say?
Knees are all right. Yeah, I'm running very slowly. I'm building up a base.
Excellent.
As they do in the trade.
Well,
yeah,
I haven't been running at all, Ben, this week because, I ran 100 miles last weekend. I don't like to talk about it, though.
No, I haven't mentioned it.
But it's been nice, actually.
How are your legs now?
Getting there. Yeah, getting there. Slightly sore right knee, but feeling increasingly okay. And I reckon I might have a go at 10k PB next. Seems like the logical place to go after 100 miles.
Does it? Is there logic to that? Just sounds like you're picking numbers. Things that have a one and a zero.
Well, we'll see how it works out. I reckon it's time to welcome our guest of the week.
Guest of the week.
Guest of the week. Here in the studio. Guest of the week. Sometimes on the phone. Could be an athlete. Could be a physio. Or a complete unknown.
Welcoming to the studio, complete unknowns, Andy Dixon and John Carroll. I'm joking, of course. You are our valued and esteemed colleagues at Runners World, so thanks very much for joining us on the podcast.
A pleasure.
Great to be here.
Sounds like it.
Sorry, a great pleasure to be here.
Today we're discussing our favourite running books. Before we begin, some rules. So each reader is given three largely uninterrupted minutes to make the case for their book before we open the floor to questions. No biting, no gouging, no strikes below the belt. Andy, as editor-in-chief at Runners World, you get to begin. So your 3 minutes on your favourite running book starts now.
And he's off. So my book is called 2 Hours, and it's by Ed Caesar. And it's subtitled The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon, so obviously the sub-2 marathon. The title is a little bit misleading because it's actually about the history of marathon running and the history of the marathon itself. It's that rare thing. It's a book about running that I think would appeal to non-runners. It's just a brilliant sports book. It's written with the pacing and the narrative economy and the drama of a thriller. It really pelts by like a great race, I suppose. It's a little over 200 pages, 10 chapters. You can read it in a couple of days. And it's just really compelling. It's got two main strands in it. One strand is the story of the Kenyan elite runner, Geoffrey Mutai, and his kind of upbringing. He's a Kalenjin runner from Kenya, born into terrible poverty. He's the eldest of 11 children, born into a one-room house, often beaten by his father. It's a kind of rags-to-riches story, which I think we're probably quite familiar with Kenyan runners, but actually we also just take it for granted. One of the great parts of the book is where Ed Caesar talks about the leading marathoners, generally Kenyan or Ethiopian, and they just seem effortless to us. And all of the slog and the work that they put in to get where they are, we just assume that it's effortless. And actually what he does is go into the nitty-gritty. So he watches Muay Thai training in Kenya. When, you know, he talks about when Muay Thai was 18, you know, Lionel Messi was already at Barcelona earning millions. Jeffrey Musai was breaking stones in a quarry. And it's just, and he brings the same approach to his training. He just breaks stones. You know, the guts and the effort is really hard. It's not at all romantic. He talks about alcoholism in Kenya. He talks about the civil war. He talks about doping in Kenya being widespread. So it's a real clear-eyed view. And then interspersed with that is the history of the marathon and also how it's developed from ancient Greece into the 1896 Olympics. You know, that kind of familiar narrative. But, you know, you could read this book and have a good grounding on the history of the marathon, why it's so great, why there's so much drama. And he's really clear-sighted on the quest for 2 hours. This was written actually in 2015. Before the Nike Sub 2 attempt. And he pretty much nails it. He says it will be done on, not in a race, it'll be done on a flat course, a loop, with a weather window. Shoes will have got better, they have. The asphalt might need to change, nutrition will be better. And actually all of those things, as we've seen, came to pass. So that just is a signal of how well-researched this book is, that he kind of nails what the two-hour marathon attempt will be.
Yeah.
Time's up.
Excellent. Excellent case for 2 hours there. Yeah, you're so right about how prescient it is about, because he calls it the moonshot marathon, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And at the time, it was like, I remember reading that thinking, well, that doesn't sound very likely that they're going to do that. And then, what, 2 or 3 years later, exactly those conditions.
There was the paper, wasn't there, that started it all. There's a scientific research paper that was like 1993 or something, it was published?
91. Yeah.
So that was like the science and the math behind what would need to be done for the sub two. Mm. And that sort of spurred into the project itself. And then I guess that's when the wheels began turning in terms of where we ended up with this book. But
yeah.
I mean, it's super interesting.
It's a really interesting subject. That study that you refer to actually was by a guy called Mike Joyner. And he predicted that the best possible levels of running economy, VO2 max and lactate threshold, the best possible time that could be achieved by a man is 157.58.
Yeah.
Wow. And that's as good as it'll get.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's a couple of recent documentaries from Ineos on the 159 challenge and they've asked all of Kipchoge's training partners about how fast they think he's going to do it.
Oh, cool.
And obviously, you know, they've got his back, so we can sort of, you know, perhaps their assessments aren't particularly, you know, but you know, some of them are saying he's got a 158 in him. So, I mean, there's some punchy chat already out there for this challenge in September? October?
Yeah, October.
October in Austria.
One criticism I've heard about this book, Andy, is that it concentrates almost exclusively on male runners. And I guess the sub-2 challenge is it's going to be a male runner who does that certainly first.
Yeah.
Do you think that in any way is a failing of the book that doesn't talk more about the female marathon?
Yes, possibly. I mean, as you say, it's likely that the sub-2, more than likely the sub-2 barrier will be broken by a man just because they are running faster in marathon environments. Mm. But yeah, I mean, it's about Kenyan male runners, basically, the kind of marathon strand of this. So yeah, I guess you could level that at it. I think the other thing about it is that, you know, Ed Caesar hitches his wagon to Jeffrey Muay Thai. Mm. And, of course, in the course of his research, he has to make a choice of which character he's going to follow. And I suppose at the time, Muay Thai looked like the star.
Right.
And actually, Muay Thai's career blossomed and then fell away pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So although that adds to the kind of poignancy, because he really just had 2 or 3 years in the sun, as it were, as an elite marathon runner. It's not like he's still around. You know, one of the interesting, it's laced with interesting detail. You know, after he becomes successful and becomes a dollar millionaire, he still chooses to train in Kenya in a one-roomed house.
Mm.
and you know, doing his own washing, washing himself in a bucket, because he believed, and he didn't have to, but he believed that actually self-sufficiency and sacrifice was a training approach that really helped. And actually, Ed Caesar believes that Kalenjin, Kenyans being born into hardship and poverty is part of the secret of their running success, because they know what it's like to suffer.
That's the Zatopek approach too, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because he would run with his wife while wearing army boots in the snow.
Yeah.
Or dip his feet into buckets of ice just to make himself tougher.
Yeah.
And he wasn't bad in the end.
Indeed.
He did okay, didn't he? Well, thanks very much, Andy. Maybe we could go to John. John, what book have you picked?
I have picked Chris McDougall's publishing juggernaut, Born to Run, which I don't know whether anything more can be said about it, but I'll give it a go. It's a wildly enthusiastic, sometimes over-the-top story about the very shy and some would say primitive Tarahumara tribe in the Copper Canyon in Chihuahua, northwestern Mexico. Think Tarahumara, just think of an Irish heroine in a terrible novel and you're halfway there, the correct pronunciation. And reporter and author McDougall refers to them as a near mythical tribe of Stone Age super athletes, which gives some indication to the kind of style he's approached. They are a very shy bunch of people, but they are apparently extraordinary runners, and they'll think nothing of running up to 50 or 100 miles a day. They make running part of their lives, it's part of the social fabric, and they do it all in these very basic flat shoes made of rubber. That have since been picked up by certain American manufacturers. The book has sold 3 million copies, and it's been made into a film at some point, apparently, so its popularity cannot be denied. McDougall was a runner who was consistently injured, and so through this eccentric American runner called Caballo Blanco, also known as Mika True, he came across the Tarahumara, and the book follows the progress of these guys as they try to arrange a race in Copper Canyon with the Tarahumara and against some of the finest US long distance athletes, including Scott Jurek, who is possibly the best of all time. Interspersed with all of this, there are stories and potted histories of certain other athletes, such as Zatopek, whom we mentioned a bit earlier on, and Dina Castor. And he mentions other races that the Tarahumara have taken part in, such as the Leadville 100. And later on, there's a lengthy digression about the history of running and the evolution of running and how we became the people we are through, he argues, and other scientists have argued, running. What I like about this book is the enthusiasm. It's fascinated with its subject, and he's clearly a fanboy, and it's very entertaining. And you can read it even if you're not a runner, although it does presume a certain degree of knowledge, but it's written in such a vibrant, punchy style that you can go with it throughout. And I'm inclined to take as the best summation of it from Ambie Burfoot, former RWUS editor, who said, "It's a running book. The tangents are all running related, running and shoes, running and running form, running and performance nutrition, running and evolution. If you don't like the asides, and there are plenty, that's me, you can skip to the race." So it culminates in this very exciting last couple of chapters in which these Tarahumara people run against these great runners, and I won't tell you what happens, although given that 3 million have already read it, a number of people already know the outcome. It's a thrilling read by and large.
Was it the running aspects of it that you enjoy the most, or is it actually sort of the insight into this culture that exists and separately, and these guys just run and that's part of what they do?
That's the most interesting part of it. Yeah. Is the insight into this culture, into this ancient tribe, and the other bits are, to me, less interesting. Mm. They are lengthy digressions. They go on chapters here and there. Yeah. And he does have a habit of inserting himself into situations and to recreate them in a way that simply he couldn't know because he wasn't there. Yeah. But that's the style of new journalism that emerged in the late 60s. So that's not new at all.
Yeah.
And he does have the very particular American style. So either you're going to go with it or you're just going to become a bit ticked off that he's in the thoughts of another runner when he simply couldn't have been.
Got it. Mm. Yeah.
What do you? Because I really enjoyed it. I think it's a page turner.
Mm-hmm.
I think it deserves its success. But what I've kept irritating me about the book,
I know where you're going here.
McDougall's he kind of has got a tendency to. I don't think the story that he's chosen to tell needs exaggeration, but he exaggerates wildly in places, and he makes some very possibly arguable claims about, you know, shoes being designed to injure runners.
Yeah.
He makes a great sweeping statement at the start of the book saying that whenever America is in crisis, running becomes more popular.
Yeah.
Like the post-Vietnam led to the jogging boom of the 70s.
To which my rejoinder is it happening now in America? Because God knows they're in crisis at the moment.
It's true.
Point made. So I found that a little bit distracting.
Yeah, I find that kind of stuff distracting too. And some of the writing is straining a little bit to be really exciting. I'm going to just read out one. This is early on. When it comes to ultra distances, nothing can beat a Tarahumara runner. Not a racehorse, not a cheetah, not an Olympic marathon. Well, none of these does ultra distances.
A cheetah, famous for running hundreds of miles.
That's like saying nothing can beat a Tarahumara, not a John Carroll.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Pretty easily done.
Yeah.
Were you inspired, John, to kick off your shoes and try barefoot running
afterwards? No, I wasn't, for two reasons. One, it really hurts my feet to do that. And the other is that because it's not a critical book, he's such a fanboy that there's never the other opinion discussed. Like, he brooks no dissent. Like, the people he doesn't like in the book, he doesn't like them a lot, and that's primarily Nike.
Yeah.
And he's got no time for Dean Karnatsis either.
No.
And he... There are certain people described in the book who have, since it came out, wished they'd been consulted a bit more beforehand. Even Caballo Blanco later on said that he wished it had been a chance to proofread it, because the depiction of him as this wild eccentric wasn't really who he was. And he since unfortunately died, but he didn't like having to live up to this image that had been created for him. But the success is deserved. It's a really thrilling read. Pinch of salt in certain places.
I mean, its impact is undeniable. You shed shoes for this, from this book, didn't
and
you?
And tears.
Oh, yes. I did. I think I wouldn't be in this job if it wasn't for Born to Run.
There you go.
That big an impact on me, because I wasn't really running before reading it.
Well, what was it for you that had the impact?
I just think it's such an inspiring read. And I think that it's particularly inspiring if you don't know much about running coming to it, because you can believe it all. You can think, that's amazing, I am born to run. Okay, I went out and got the Vibrams, I got injured. But by that point, I'd sort of really was inspired by running and really kind of had drunk some of the Kool-Aid. And then you kind of work out, actually, like, some of this is a bit fast and loose with the truth. As far as a book that makes running seem really thrilling and exciting, I don't think there's a better book, actually, for that.
Well, let's talk about my book.
Having said that, Ben, tell us.
Having
about your
said
book.
That, well, I'm going to throw a sort of a literary spanner in the mix here, which is that, as you're just, you know, rightly so, all talking about books that are quite emotive and conjure a great sort of sentiment towards running, mine is a very pragmatic training book.
Yes.
So it's not necessarily. So I'm talking about Hansen's half marathon training training method book, which is, when I first started at Runner's World, one of the first books I picked up to read with a half marathon coming up. And I'd used some training plans before, you know, books that, like,
And I got into it, and it made sense to me. I mean, it offered me solutions to running problems that I had. Now, that's why I'm bringing the training book into this mix, because I feel like you take away great sentiment and ideals about running from these books, and they inspire and they bring you forward. But when they put you somewhere like that, as yourself, you said, you went and got some Vibrams and you got injured.
Sure.
You see, so in my point of view, you read this book, oh no, none of that. It's telling you what to do. It informs your running a little bit more. Away you go with all this new information that you're taking, which is specific to your running journey. It's not someone else's journey. There's no sort of exaggeration to make it sound better. I'm not going to say it's dry as a read.
But
I mean, you might want to sort of not read it all at once. I'd say sort of choose chapters to sort of inform yourself and process and then go back to it. But I wanted to just, I'm going to talk about Hansen's because it's the first one that I read and I enjoyed it because it taught me a lot. And I think the half marathon's a great distance to learn about when it comes to running and from a sort of purely scientific, physical capabilities race. It's that perfect mix of speed and endurance, and it sets you up for sort of shorter 10Ks or the marathon itself. It kind of, you know, it's a really nice middle ground of learning how to train the body to work hard. So that's my book.
Love it.
What is it about their training approach that you found amenable to you? Do they do anything different? Is it kind of
so it's quite high volume. I think it's quite old school, so it's not like, and that's not necessarily great for me. I'm not particularly a high volume runner, so I don't do 60 mile weeks. I don't think my body's that good at that. But at the same time, with all training plans that I've ever really used, you adapt them, I mean, really to yourself. So when I was reading it, it was more just actually sort of the processes. It's the build up. It's the structured around when to do sessions, how to manage those sessions. The hard and fast stuff that really matters when it comes to getting good at a race, that's where the book really kind of like shone for me in terms of like, I guess as a rookie runner, I was kind of like learning on the fly. So I was a bit like, oh, I've done some running before. And then all of a sudden you read this book and it tells you about how to get faster, but not just like, you know, the ins and outs. And but back to yours. Yeah, it's not new because it's quite an old book now, but there's no real new science to it. But at the time it was pretty much on the money in terms of how to do it properly.
I remember this is a quote by Frank Zappa, and he was talking about music journalism. He said, writing about music is a bit like dancing about architecture.
Right.
And his point was, it's just the wrong medium to discuss it. You can't like sum up the passion and the immediacy of music in words. Do you think that the running book actually works? Do you think a book ever actually like gives you that kind of the same excitement as actually just going running?
Yeah.
If you're prepared to go with it and allow for the fact that it will be somebody in somebody's head talking about what's going on in their head and to their body, and they can present something outside of that as well, then yeah, why not? It's and clearly it's working.
Yeah.
And these books are very well received, and they sell well, and they're critically acclaimed. So there's market for them.
Yeah, 3 million copies.
And the good ones are terrific.
Yeah. Talking about terrific running books.
Come on then, what's yours?
It's no coincidence, Ben, that Running's Best Book comes courtesy of Running's Best Writer. I speak, of course, of Feet in the Clouds by Richard Asquith. For those unfamiliar with this mighty tome, it's an homage to the obscure northern sport of fell running, written by a 13-stone southern toff. And that's Richard Asquith's description, not mine. What I love most about the book is the quality of the writing, which is every bit as beautiful as the kind of Lakeland landscape that it describes. Couple of lines from the first page. This is how death must feel, not the pain, although I imagine most deaths must be painful, but the fear. This is not despair. This is the raw animal distress of the wounded and terrified.
Blimey, calm down,
mate. It's a lot better than I hit the wall, isn't it?
I did 4 miles at lunch and didn't feel anything like that.
Also like the fact the book is quintessentially British. So whereas in Born to Run you have the kind of sun-baked copper canyons and the quasi-mystical Taramar Indians, in Feet in the Clouds you have sort of the rain-soaked Lake District and a bunch of eccentric sheep farmers. And it's a reminder to me that you don't have to travel far to have a running adventure. Mm. Actually, a lot of that stuff is in the wild places of Britain. Some of the book's best moments come when Asquith describes Fell Running's Mavericks. My particular favourite is the late, great Eddie Campbell, who's perhaps the only man to have run up Ben Nevis 800 times. And certainly the only one to do so while wearing only a pair of battered green flash plimsolls and a red bandana. He was wearing shorts, I'm sure, as well.
Good.
And then alongside it is Asker's own attempt to complete the Bob Graham Round. It's a classic fell running challenge involving the scaling of 42 peaks within 24 hours. And without spoiling the ending, it's a journey full of up and downs, literally, and provides a bit of a really compelling narrative. He never pretends to be a running expert at all. He's the opposite. He says he kind of positions himself as a bit of a novice. But there's some really, really good advice in there, and he's struggling on this 10-mile run about 2 weeks out from one of his Bob Graham attempts. And he says, so I made a deal with myself. Do this run without stopping, and you will do the Bob Graham. I knew this was nonsense, as such deals always are. I also knew it was true. To surrender now would be to surrender always. If I wished to have anything more to do with fell running, there was only one option. Keep going. Keep going, whatever happens, however long it takes, however much it hurts. Keep going or die trying. All moments are contained in this moment. Master this moment and anything is possible. And I think that's great. If you're ever trying to train for a marathon, you think, God, this session's really difficult. And you think, if I can't do one more rep here, like this dream of me running this certain time for a marathon, I might as well just give up now. Like all moments are contained in this one moment. I think that's really great running advice. Like any great book, I think it changes the reader's life if you read it. There's definitely no way I would have tried the Ennerdale Horseshoe, one of the classic Lakeland fell races, had I not read the book. And I definitely shouldn't have tried that. And I think that's a question about possibly the troubled legacy of this book. But I think even if you've got no intention of going fell running, it's worth reading it just for the quality of the language. It's really beautiful. And at the last page, he starts pondering his own mortality. So I'll just read you this last bit. And the thought for some reason slips into my head that when it is my turn to die, there might be worse ways to prepare than to gaze once more on a sight like this. Perhaps, I muse, one or more of my children might consider taking me to Keswick in my last days, and depending on their fitness and mine, leading me or wheeling me on one final expedition into the mountains. And though I may have lost the power of speech by then, my escorts can reasonably assume that as I gaze, my head will be full of fell-running joy and glory, of Joss Naylor hurrying invincibly through endless scorched rock fields, of Pete Bland, trance-eyed with delight on the ambleside finishing line, and of Kenny Stewart, dancing like an angel on the points of needle-sharp rocks, light and sure-footed as the rest of us are in dreams. Take a bow, Richard Asker. If you've written running's best book, clearly.
A lot of death in that book.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Yes. You mentioned death a lot.
Yeah, each excerpt you read contained references to death.
Also, lots of stuff about life, really, and the life-enhancing joys of fell running. But it's a fantastic book, I think.
I think that the book, you choosing this book, tells us more about you, Rick, as a certified romantic man, rather than the book itself.
Well, it is a romantic book. It definitely is. And he's a very romantic writer, Richard Asquith, and very lyrical. And it's a deeply personal book. And like one of the points there about kind of propelling me into the lakes to try fell running, I think is one of the criticisms that the book has, is that it kind of opened the door to southern softies such as myself into what is a very private sport. And I would imagine Chesky probably feels quite troubled about that, because I think he was very aware that he was sort of dipping his toe into a world that he's not, perhaps.
You can't take that approach with a book, though. That just, you don't write the book then. You know,
that's true.
And why would you do that? Would you censor yourself in such a fashion?
Mm. Also, isn't the I've read the book, but I haven't done a fell race, so I'm just kind of, I enjoyed the kind of lyrical aspect of it. But I got the impression that the fell running community is actually quite welcoming
of
the book, of newcomers and people who are going to dip their toes in and try the sport.
I think that's true. I think there's a kind of idea that fell running is this very insular, perhaps unwelcoming thing, that's not, in my very brief experience, that wasn't the case at all. In fact, on the Ennerdale Horseshoe, we were very much dependent on the goodwill of fell runners actually getting us around safely. So yeah, I think it's much more welcoming than perhaps it's made out to be. Yeah.
But I think it's just another one of the examples of a book that's focused around a very unique side of running. Is what makes that story. I mean, it's obviously very well written, but it's that part of it that makes it very engaging. So you've got this in, you know, we all might be aware of the fell running community, but it's much like, you know, a tribe of people that we've never heard of before running. It's immediately engaging because you're suddenly just like, what the hell are they talking about? This sounds mental. Who runs like that? And then straight away you're in, and that's why the book,
you know, it has, running has that great ability to not just be about the daily rigors of going for a run. There's like these real sort of like cultural significant movements happening that are then suddenly turned into these great books.
Yeah, and I think in some ways it was an unlikely, you know, the fell running, it's not the obvious thing to write about. They're quite an unlikely community to give rise to this kind of iconic running.
Well, it's a testament to good writing too, and you can take a topic that's that esoteric and little known and turn it into a very fine and well-received book, then, you know, you've done it.
Very quickly, any running books that you dislike or ones you're disappointed by?
Murakami's book disappointed me.
Me too. Because
I didn't quite know what he was trying to get across, and what he did get across I didn't find terribly interesting.
Apart from that, though.
Loved it.
Yeah, I thought that he was, because he was possibly the most celebrated author to ever write about running. He was going to bring something to the table that we'd never thought of before. Like, oh my God, I can't believe it, that I didn't think about running in
that
way.
And he's put it so beautifully. But
yes, exactly.
I didn't get any of that in it.
Have you read it, Andy?
Murakami, yes. And I can't really remember a lot of what it was about, just a lot of philosophical musings.
Yeah.
Which haven't really stuck with me. So yeah, I would agree.
I just asked some friends what they like. My mate Andy came back with one called Footnotes by Vibar Cregan Reed.
Right.
If anyone's read that, I've never read it, but this is just on the list now. So that's another thing. There's another one for everyone to check out.
Yeah, and I'd recommend Marathon Man by William Goldman. It's a thriller, but it's an excellent one. And there is some running in it.
There we go.
And Island Joggings, a very little known
self-published
memoir, worth checking out.
Well, yeah, we do receive quite a few self-published ones of mixed quality, I would say.
I'd say so.
Annie and John, thanks so much for coming on and talking more about your favourite running books. Great to
very
have you
great
on
pleasure.
We'd like to, I think, all anyone who listens who agrees or wants to vote, cast a vote
on which
book you think is best. Obviously mine. Email us at podcast@runnersworld.co.uk, and we'll probably put something up on the internet so everyone can vote once this is live.
Ben, who monitors the email address?
Me.
Interesting.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
That was some fantastic book chat.
We're going very highbrow, aren't we?
No, one episode. We'll go back to the normal stuff before. But keeping it highbrow, we're going to welcome into the studio now Jane McGuire with some weekly running news.
Hello.
Jane, what's been catching your eye this week?
I'm going to start with the worst story of the week. It's dark. Prepare you all. A runner has been murdered by a mother and son over the use of a footpath which ran across their property. And Gary Dean, who is the runner, ran London Marathon 18 times.
Oh, God.
Very sad.
Where was this?
This was in Barnsley.
South
Yorkshire. His route went across the Dawsons, is that correct, the family?
I think so, yeah.
Across the land. And years of disputing it and, you know, back and forth apparently between the two has resulted in this man's untimely death.
That's terrible.
Right?
Yeah.
So how things escalate.
Yeah.
So that is a bit of stark running news there.
Yeah.
And then to lighten things, Jess Anderson, who we might all remember as the nurse who ran 3:08 in London.
Yes.
And she was wearing scrubs and there was this whole thing with the Guinness World Records and...
Yeah, right.
You know, the uniform. She's been awarded a silver medal by the chief nursing officer to recognise her excellence.
That's great.
Nice, yeah.
And what, in terms of that, that's an award, I assume, just for the nursing community.
Yeah. And the chief nursing officer, Dr. Ruth May, said that part of what she did was leave a legacy that the uniform perception had to change.
There so, you know,
yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
The greater power of running.
Yeah.
So the idea that you could be a doctor, but in scrubs, as opposed to sort of, you know, just
I think
your
it
white.
Was
yeah, yeah. So the preconceived notion of what a nurse's uniform was kind of like your Halloween fancy dress, sexy nurse.
Right.
That was
right.
What the world record holder was. Well, it was attributed before.
Yeah, it had to be a dress.
Right, right.
Obviously, women.
And she ran in her scrubs, which is
dresses.
Her uniform. And so there was a whole hubbubaloo about the whole thing. Anyway. Guinness World Record were great. They apologised and said, "You're right. This is your uniform, and you are now the world record holder."
Oh, that's good.
So there we go.
Yeah. And last news, which is shocking, is a 12-year-old who has run in Vancouver a 10K in 36 minutes, 52 seconds.
Is it?
She's also done a 5K in 17 minutes.
So not a fluke?
No. And she said, I don't really train, I just run.
It's frankly sickening. But well done to her.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's phenomenal. 12-year-old girl, 36.52. Yeah. My word.
It's amazing. Considering that the majority of 12-year-olds are probably more inactive than they've ever been in the whole entire world of humans ever.
Yeah.
And then there's one just smashing out sub 37.
Yeah, it's amazing. I remember I went to Park Run about 4 months ago with my wife, Georgie, who does listen to this. And she said, my nemesis is here. and I thought, oh.
Everyone's got
a running nemesis. And, yeah. You know, and it's like there. And I was looking around for like someone of a similar age, basically. And the crowd parts. And it was this like 10-year-old boy who was running with his dad. It's like, that's my nemesis. He always pips me at, you know, in the last 50 yards. We actually did finish before that person that day.
That's
good. I appreciate it's not a race, but I think there are these little rivalries do exist.
For sure. If you attend everything once a week, you're going to see the same faces.
Yeah. Same kid.
Yeah.
So it's funny. So, yeah, you can start thinking, well, you know, get to 12 and certainly like 14, 15, some of these kids are absolutely rapid.
So I'm going to assume straight away that she's probably part of a running club or something like that. But when I always want to know, is it like talent scouts? Like, is there someone who reads that and suddenly goes, we've got one? And they go off and, you know, she's suddenly sponsored and she's like, she's in a training camp somewhere and she's like, that's it. That's her life set for her now because she's got this natural ability.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I feel like if you were that good at football as a 12-year-old,
yeah,
you'd be on.
Oh, you'd already be. Books, you'd already you? Be in a youth academy something, wouldn't you? Mm. So there we go. Well, what's her name again?
I'm gonna say Sydney Soarenga.
Right, everyone. Look.
Sorry if I've got that wrong.
No. Sydney. Doesn't sound like your
name.
That's how exactly how she pronounces it. Yeah,
that's how
it.
She says it every day.
Wow.
This is a name for the future, everyone. Sydney.
How would you say that?
Swayenga. I'm going to go with.
Thanks for clearing that up, Ben.
Well, there we go.
Yeah.
Rick, do you want to have a go? We can, you know, all three of us can be embarrassing.
That's that's Sydney Smith there from Vancouver. No, yeah, absolutely amazing. Fair play, Sydney. 36.52, not bad at all.
Phenomenal. Well done, the kids.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So that brings us to the end of this week's Runner's World podcast. I'd like to say a huge thanks to our guests, Andy Dixon and John Carroll, and to Number 8 Studios in Soho, where this was recorded.
For more news, reviews, interviews, and much, much more from the wider world of running, please head over to runnersworld.com/UK. Please like and subscribe on iTunes. Thanks to Acast, our hosting partner, and thanks very much to you for listening. We will see you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.